Disc 10. In theory, the convention had a mandate only to revise the Articles of Confederation. Any delegates who took this circumscribed mission at face value were soon rudely disabused. On May 30th, Edmund Randolph presented a plan, formulated chiefly by Madison, that sought to scuttle the Articles altogether and create a strong central government. This Virginia plan made a clean break with the past and contained the basic design of the future U.S. government. It provided for a bicameral legislature with both houses based on proportional representation. As the most populous state, Virginia had a vested interest in this approach. It concentrated extra power in the executive branch by calling for a one-person executive, that is, a president, with a 7-year term, rather than the council favored by radicals. To heighten the separation of powers, it envisioned a national judiciary crowned by a supreme tribunal. The Virginia plan left little doubt that while the states would retain some sovereignty, they would be subservient to the federal government. After Randolph's presentation, Hamilton confronted delegates with the core question of whether the new government should muddle on as a confederation or form a true nation. They should debate whether the United States were susceptible to one government or whether each state needed a separate existence connected only by leagues. Hamilton saw the vital importance of the national government possessing ultimate sovereignty. The positive reaction to his statement revealed that the delegates were ready to embark on vigorous reform, and the convention agreed overwhelmingly that a national government ought to be established consisting of a supreme legislature, executive, and judiciary. Robert Yates at once exposed the irreparable split in the New York delegation by voting against Hamilton's motion. Had John Lansing Jr. arrived by this time, he would surely have done likewise. For many delegates, a separation of federal powers was one thing, a sharp diminution of state power quite another. Small states trembled at the thought of a bicameral legislature with both houses chosen by proportional representation. On June 15th, William Patterson of New Jersey furnished the convention with a notably divergent vision. Instead of raising the old structure to erect a brand new government, Patterson wanted to correct the Articles of Confederation and retain basic state sovereignty. Instead of two houses of Congress, the New Jersey plan envisioned one chamber, with each state casting one vote. It also retained the voluntary system of requisitions that had hobbled the country's finances. In place of a president, the plan contemplated an executive council that could be removed by a majority of the state governors. For obvious reason, many large states gravitated toward the Virginia plan, while smaller states coalesced around the New Jersey plan. Though a delegate from the fifth largest state, John Lansing expressed warm admiration for the New Jersey plan, since it sustains the sovereignty of the respective states. He chided the Virginia plan. The states will never sacrifice their essential rights to a national government. So visceral was Lansing's revulsion against Madison's plan that he said that if New York had suspected a new national government would be contemplated, it would never have sent delegates to Philadelphia. Lansing's speech confirmed Hamilton's minority status in his delegation, reducing his influence on the convention floor. For those who knew Hamilton, his generally passive behavior during the first 3 weeks was mystifying. He had never been known to hug the sidelines. As the convention split over the Virginia and New Jersey plans, Hamilton stayed conspicuously aloof from both camps. Robert Yates noted on June 15th, "Colonel Hamilton cannot say he is in sentiment with either plan." Madison recorded Hamilton as saying that he had been self-effacing partly because he did not wish to dissent from those whose superior abilities, age, and experience rendered him unwilling to bring forward ideas dissimilar to theirs, and partly owing to the split in his delegation. It was predictable that when the wordy Hamilton broke silence, he would do so at epic length. Faced with a deadlock between large and small states, he decided to broach a more radical plan. On Monday morning, June 18th, the 32-year-old prodigy rose first on the convention floor, and in the stifling, poorly ventilated room, he spoke and spoke and spoke. Before the day was through, he had given a 6-hour speech, no break for lunch, that was brilliant, courageous, and in retrospect, completely daft. He admitted to the assembly that he would adumbrate a plan that did not reflect popular opinion. "My situation is disagreeable," he admitted, "but it would be criminal not to come forward on a question of such magnitude." He said people were tiring in their enthusiasm for democracy, by which he meant direct representation or even mob rule, as opposed to public opinion filtered through educated representatives. "And what even is the Virginia plan," he asked, "but democracy checked by democracy, or pork with a little change of the sauce?" Of all the founders, Hamilton probably had the gravest doubts about the wisdom of the masses and wanted elected leaders who would guide them. This was the great paradox of his career. His optimistic view of America's potential coexisted with an essentially pessimistic view of human nature. His faith in Americans never quite matched his faith in America itself. It was typical of Hamilton's egotism, expansive imagination, and supernormal intellect that he refused to settle for refinements on somebody else's plan. His mind had minted an entire program for a new government, not just scattered aspects of it. In future years, he reminded critics that the deliberations had been kept secret precisely so that delegates could provoke debate and voice controversial ideas without fear of reprisals. Instead, his speech acquired diabolical status in the rumor mills of the early republic, providing gloating opponents with damning proof of his supposed political apostasy. Though we have no written transcript of the speech, the sometimes conflicting notes left by Hamilton, Madison, Yates, Lansing, and Rufus King agree in most essentials. Ever since his September 1780 letter to James Duane, Hamilton had toyed with creating a new hybrid form of government that would have the continuity of a monarchy combined with the liberties of a republic, guarding against both anarchy and tyranny. He now suggested a president and senate that would be elected but would then serve for life on good behavior. Hamilton's chief executive differed from a hereditary monarch because he would be elected and, if he misbehaved, subject to recall. It will be objected probably that such an executive will be an elective monarch and will give birth to the tumults which characterize that form of government, Madison scribbled as Hamilton declaimed. He would reply that monarch is an indefinite term. It marks not either the degree or duration of power. It scarcely helped Hamilton's historical reputation that in his personal notes he observed of this monarch, "He ought to be hereditary and to have so much power that it will not be his interest to risk much to acquire more." Hamilton edited this from his talk, however, and never openly advocated a hereditary monarchy, as evidenced by Madison's reference to an elective monarch. And nowhere else in Hamilton's vast body of work does he support a hereditary executive. Even here, in his most extreme statement, he called for a chief executive subject to ultimate legislative control. However atrociously misguided the idea was, it fell short of proposing a real monarchy in which a king has permanent, autonomous, hereditary powers that supersede those of all other branches of government. While Hamilton's Senate would be chosen for life by electors, his House of Representatives, by contrast, was exceedingly democratic, chosen directly by universal male suffrage every 3 years. Thus, the aristocratic element would be represented by the Senate, the common folk by the House. As prosperity widened income differentials in future years, Hamilton feared that the Senate and House might try to impose their wills on each other. "Give all power to the many, they will oppress the few. Give all power to the few, they will oppress the many." The system needed an impartial arbiter to transcend class warfare and regional interests, and here Hamilton muddied the waters by using the dreaded word monarch. "This check is a monarch. There ought to be a principle in government capable of resisting the popular current." Fearing aristocrats as well as commoners, Hamilton wanted to restrain abusive majorities and minorities. "Demagogues are not always inconsiderable persons," he responded to one Madison speech. "Patricians were frequently demagogues." To curb further abuse, Hamilton recommended a Supreme Court that would consist of 12 judges holding lifetime offices on good behavior. In this manner, each branch would maintain a salutary distance from popular passions. The House of Representatives would be the striking exception. Hamilton concluded, "The principle chiefly intended to be established is this, that there must be a permanent will." No less inflammatory to some listeners was Hamilton's assessment of the former mother country. In his private opinion, Madison recorded, he had no scruple in declaring that the British government was the best in the world, and that he doubted much whether anything short of it would do in America. For future conspiracy theorists, this admission clinched the case. Hamilton was a dangerous traitor, ready to sell America back into bondage to Britain. In fact, admiration for the British political system was still widespread. At one point, Pierce Butler of South Carolina remarked that the delegates were constantly running away with the idea of the excellence of the British Parliament, and with or without reason, copying from them. But Hamilton's detractors were to interpret his view as one of uniquely servile adoration for the British system, with a desire to import it to America. When he finished, Hamilton received a polite smattering of applause. Perhaps the delegates were glad to escape the heat and head for their lodgings. Governor Morris extolled Hamilton's speech as the most able and impressive he had ever heard. William Samuel Johnson of Connecticut said that Hamilton's speech has been praised by everybody, but supported by none. Years later, John Quincy Adams lauded the plan as one of great ability and even better in theory than the one adopted, however misplaced in an American setting. How had Hamilton blundered into this speech? That Hamilton had an abiding fear of mob rule did not distinguish him from most delegates. What did distinguish him was that his fears had triumphed so completely over his hopes. He was so busy clamping checks and balances on potentially fickle citizens that he did not stop to consider the potential of the electorate. Hamilton often seemed a man suspended between two worlds. He never supported a nobility, hereditary titles, or the other trappings of aristocracy. He never again uttered a kind word for monarchy. Still, he wondered whether Republican government could withstand popular frenzy and instill the deep respect for law and authority that obtained in monarchical systems and that would safeguard liberties. Too often, his political vision harked back to a past in which well-bred elites made decisions for less educated citizens. This contradicted the advanced economic thinking expressed in his vision of a fluid, meritocratic elite, open to talented outsiders such as himself. Incorrigibly honest, Hamilton must have felt duty-bound to provide an alternative to the Virginia and New Jersey plans, which he thought certain to fail. He must have believed that if no consensus was reached, his speech would be dusted off and its merits belatedly better appreciated. Until then, he would rely on the secrecy of the proceedings. Hamilton was not the only delegate who offered harebrained ideas. At one point, Hugh Williamson of North Carolina claimed that it was pretty certain that we should at some time or other have a king. Four states even voted for Hamilton's proposal of a president serving during good behavior, most notably the Virginia delegation that included James Madison, George Mason, and Edmund Randolph. When later taunted by the Jeffersonians, Hamilton was pleased to remind them that Madison, too, had favored such a president. If he was a monarchist, so was Madison. Madison also insisted upon giving the federal government a veto over state laws, as the King of Great Britain heretofore had. Benjamin Franklin wanted a unicameral legislature and an executive council in lieu of a president. He also opposed a presidential veto on legislation, thinking it would lead to executive corruption till it ends in monarchy. John Dickinson wanted state legislatures to have the power to impeach the president. Elbridge Gerry wanted a three-man presidency, with each member representing a different section of America. Though not a delegate, John Adams thought hereditary rule inevitable and prophesied, "Our ship must ultimately land on that shore." For the great majority of delegates, Hamilton's speech was just a day-long respite from the fierce infighting at hand. The next morning, nobody even took time to refute Hamilton. Madison feared that Hamilton's speech would alienate small states at a critical moment. In fact, Madison's Virginia plan may have profited from Hamilton's speech because it now seemed moderate by comparison. Some scholars have argued that this was the true intent of Hamilton's speech. When Madison rose to speak, he made no reference to Hamilton's oratory and consigned it to temporary oblivion. Instead, he mercilessly dissected the New Jersey plan. Though Hamilton's plan was doomed, its effects were to linger long after the delegates had dispersed. Till the end of his days, opponents dredged up the speech as if it embodied the real Hamilton, the secret Hamilton, as if he had blurted out the truth in a moment of weakness. In fact, nobody fought harder or more effectively for the new Constitution than Hamilton, who never wavered in his resolution to support it. The June 18th speech was to prove one of three flagrant errors in his career. In each case, he was brave, detailed, and forthright on a controversial subject, as if laboring under some compulsion to express his inmost thoughts. Each time he was spectacularly wrong-headed and indiscreet, yet convinced he was right. Only one thing was certain. This verbose, headstrong, loose-tongued man made poor material for the conspirator conjured up by his enemies. After his controversial speech, Hamilton lapsed into temporary silence as the large and small states squared off in a tense deadlock. It seemed the divided convention might collapse. When Franklin suggested on June 28th that each session start with a prayer for heavenly help, Hamilton countered that this might foster a public impression that embarrassments and dissensions within the convention had suggested this measure. According to legend, Hamilton also rebutted Franklin with the jest that the convention didn't need foreign aid. The Lord did not seem much in evidence at this point in the convention. One story, perhaps apocryphal, claims that when Hamilton was asked why the framers omitted the word God from the Constitution, he replied, "We forgot." One is tempted to reply that Alexander Hamilton never forgot anything important. On June 29th, Hamilton mustered the will to speak again, voicing grave anxiety over the stalemated convention. "It is a miracle that we are now here exercising our tranquil and free deliberations on the subject. It would be madness to trust to future miracles." Hamilton seized the chance to enunciate his first major statement on foreign policy, noting that great nations follow their interests and contesting the chimerical view that America should concentrate on domestic tranquility while disregarding its interests abroad. "No government could give us tranquility and happiness at home which did not possess sufficient stability and strength to make us respectable abroad." He also combated the fantasy that the Atlantic Ocean would protect America from future conflicts. With these fighting words, Hamilton splashed a cold dose of realism on the sentimental isolationism of the time. After delivering these thoughts, Hamilton packed up and returned to New York the next day to attend to personal business. He was seriously and deeply distressed by the convention, he wrote to Washington. As he traveled back through New Jersey, he gathered impressions that reinforced his conviction that only tough, fearless measures could stem the country's chaos. "I fear that we shall let slip the golden opportunity of rescuing the American empire from disunion, anarchy, and misery," he informed Washington. The warring New York delegation shortly fell apart. By July 6th, Robert Yates and John Lansing Jr. had expressed their disgust with the convention also by leaving Philadelphia. Members had come and gone before, but the two New York delegates were the first to depart irrevocably on principle. Washington, aggrieved, wrote to Hamilton, "I almost despair of seeing a favorable issue to the convention, and do therefore repent having had any agency in the business." He inveighed against narrow-minded politicians under the influence of local views, who would selfishly block a strong and energetic government under the guise of protecting the people. Washington did not seem fazed by Hamilton's June 18th speech. "I am sorry you went away," he assured him. "I wish you were back." On July 16th, the thick gloom finally lifted at Philadelphia when delegates agreed to a grand bargain, the so-called Connecticut Compromise, proposed by Roger Sherman of Connecticut and others. The major conflicts at the convention had perhaps hinged less on the question of federal versus state power than on how federal representation was apportioned among the states. The delegates solved this baffling riddle by deciding that all states would enjoy equal representation in the Senate, a sop to small states, while representation in the House of Representatives would be proportionate to each state's population, a sop to large states. This broke the deadlock, though the Senate's composition introduced a lasting political bias in American life in favor of smaller states. Left in limbo by Yates and Lansing, Hamilton drifted back and forth between New York and Philadelphia that summer. Yates and Lansing never voted in one single instance with Hamilton, who was so much mortified at it that he went home, George Mason told Thomas Jefferson. When the season for courts came on, Yates, a judge, and Lansing, a lawyer, went to attend their courts. Then Hamilton returned. With Yates and Lansing gone, Hamilton still could not vote because each state needed a minimum of two delegates present, so he became a non-voting convention member. Yet he no longer had to appease delegates from his own state. Hamilton behaved civilly toward Yates and Lansing, telling them that for the sake of propriety and public opinion, he would gladly accompany them back to Philadelphia. Needless to say, neither ever took him up on the offer. Having repudiated the convention, Yates and Lansing no longer felt bound by its gag rule and briefed Governor Clinton on what was being meditated in Philadelphia. "We must candidly confess that we should have been equally opposed to any system which had in object the consolidation of the United States into one government." Perceiving a threat to his power, Clinton stated publicly that the most likely effect of any new charter would be that the country would be thrown into confusion by the measure, Hamilton recalled. Irate at this violation of the convention's confidentiality, Hamilton said that Clinton had not given the Philadelphia meeting a fair chance and had clearly betrayed an intention to excite prejudices beforehand against whatever plan should be proposed by the convention. Hamilton was spoiling for a fight as New York resounded with rumors about the events in Philadelphia. When a story appeared that delegates were colluding to bring the Duke of York, George III's second son, from Britain to head an American monarchy, Hamilton traced this absurdity to a letter sent to one James Reynolds of this city, the first reference he ever made to the man whose wife would someday be his fatal enchantress. On July 21st, Hamilton took dead aim at Governor Clinton in New York's Daily Advertiser. In an unsigned article, he accused Clinton of poisoning the electorate's mind against the ongoing work in Philadelphia, contending that such conduct in a man high in office argues greater attachment to his own power than to the public good, and furnishes strong reason to suspect a dangerous predetermination to oppose whatever may tend to diminish the former, however it may promote the latter. As so often in his career, Hamilton's assault on New York's most powerful man, the opening salvo in his protracted campaign to win New York's approval of the Constitution, seemed brave and foolhardy in equal measure. In attacking Clinton, Hamilton went straight for the jugular. The Clintonians hit back hard, spreading smears about Hamilton. While Hamilton had chastened Clinton's character to illustrate the abuses of self-serving governors, his adversaries vilified his personal reputation. They knew that Hamilton enjoyed Washington's all-important patronage and tried to soil that association in the public's mind. In a piece signed Inspector, one Clinton henchman wrote, "I have also known an upstart attorney palm himself upon a great and good man for a youth of extraordinary genius, and under the shadow of such a patronage make himself at once known and respected. He was at length found to be a superficial, self-conceited coxcomb, and was, of course, turned off and disregarded by his patron." Hamilton was deeply offended. This man born without honor was exceedingly sensitive to any slights to his political honor. As an outsider on the American scene, he did not believe that he could allow such slander to go unanswered, so he appealed to Washington to correct the distortion. "This, I confess, hurts my feelings, and if it obtains credit will require a contradiction," he told the general. Friendly toward both Hamilton and Clinton, Washington was reluctant to take sides, but confirmed to Hamilton that the charges against him were entirely unfounded. He had no reason, he said, to believe that Hamilton had taken a single step to finagle an appointment to his military family. As for the confrontation that led to Hamilton's departure, "Your quitting was altogether the effect of your own choice." Through the years, Hamilton was to exhaust himself in efforts to refute lies that grew up around him like choking vines. No matter how hard he tried to hack away at these myths, they continued to sprout deadly new shoots. These myths were perhaps the inevitable reaction to a man so brilliant, so outspoken, and so sure of himself. Before returning to Philadelphia, Hamilton averted a duel between an English merchant friend, John Aljo, and Major William Pierce, who happened to be a Georgia delegate to the Constitutional Convention. In a letter to Pierce's second, Hamilton pleaded for forgiveness of Aljo's rude behavior in a business dispute and observed that extremities ought then only to ensue when, after a fair experiment, accommodation has been found impracticable. As was often the case, the prospect of a duel concentrated the minds of both parties, enabling them to reach a settlement without resort to bloodshed. On August 6th, the Philadelphia Convention reconvened to begin the arduous task of refining the Constitution. Hamilton, back by August 13th, dove into a debate that passionately engaged him: immigration. He opposed any attempt to restrict membership in Congress to native-born Americans or to stipulate a residency period before immigrants could qualify for it. He told the Assembly that the advantage of encouraging foreigners is obvious. Persons in Europe of moderate fortunes will be fond of coming here, where they will be on a level with the first citizens. I move that the section be so altered as to require merely citizenship and inhabitancy. This position again contradicts the image of Hamilton as indifferent to the plight of ordinary people. He was overruled. Representatives would have 7-year residency requirements, senators 9, the president 14. It has been speculated that Hamilton slipped a clause into the Constitution allowing him to become eligible for the presidency. The final document stated that the president had to be at least 35 and either native-born or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution. Since Hamilton was away from Philadelphia when a committee formulated this proposal, it seems unlikely that he had any influence upon it. As Madison conceded, the specter of slavery haunted the convention, and he argued that the states were divided into different interests not by their difference of size, but principally from their having or not having slaves. The conflict did not lie between the large and small states. It lay between the northern and southern. For many southerners, the slavery issue allowed no room for concessions, and they supported the Virginia Plan in exchange for protecting their peculiar institution. Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina stated baldly, "South Carolina and Georgia cannot do without slaves." The issue was so explosive that the word slavery did not appear in the Constitution, replaced by the euphemism of people held to service or labor. Slaveholding states wondered how their human property would be counted for congressional apportionment purposes. Northern states finally agreed that 5 slaves would be counted as equivalent to 3 free whites, the infamous federal ratio that survived for another 80 years. The formula richly rewarded the southern states, artificially inflating their House seats and electoral votes, and helping to explain why 4 of the first 5 presidents hailed from Virginia. This gross inequity was to play no small part in the eventual triumph of Jeffersonian Republicans over Hamiltonian Federalists. In exchange, southern states agreed that the importation of slaves might cease after 1808, feeding an illusory hope that slavery might someday just fade away. Without the federal ratio, Hamilton glumly concluded, no union could possibly have been formed. Indeed, the whole superstructure erected in Philadelphia rested on that unstable, undemocratic foundation. Hamilton's upset over this tolerance of slavery may have been deeper than we know. There has always been some mystery as to his whereabouts after his August 13th statement on immigration. In fact, he had returned to New York for a meeting of the Manumission Society. Hamilton may have apprised members of the impending decision on slavery in Philadelphia because they delivered a petition to the convention to promote the attainment of the objects of this society. After the slavery compromise in Philadelphia, Hamilton stepped up his involvement in the Manumission Society. The following year, even while pouring out 51 Federalist essays, serving in Congress, and campaigning to ratify the Constitution, he attended a meeting of the Society that again protested the export of slaves from New York State and the outrages committed in digging up and taking away the dead bodies of Negroes buried in the city. Later in the year, Hamilton was appointed one of four counselors of the Manumission Society. By September 6th, Hamilton was back in Philadelphia, having made full peace with the new Constitution. Madison recorded Hamilton as telling delegates that he had been restrained from entering into the discussion from his dislike of the scheme in general, but as he meant to support the plan as better than nothing, he wished to offer a few remarks. On September 8th, Hamilton joined the Committee of Style and Arrangement, which would arrange the articles of the Constitution and polish its prose. The five-member committee, chaired by William Samuel Johnson, included Rufus King and James Madison, but owed much of its success to Hamilton's friend, Gouverneur Morris. Thanks to a carriage accident, Morris, 35, had a wooden leg and walked with a cane, accoutrement that only enhanced his whimsically flamboyant presence. Like Hamilton, the blue-blooded Morris dreaded mob rule and had favored a Senate made up solely of great property owners. He considered slavery a nefarious institution that would summon the curse of heaven on the states where it prevailed. Although he represented Pennsylvania at the convention, he had grown up on Morrisania, the family estate in New York. Tall and urbane, he was a stout patriot with a biting wit and a cavalier twinkle in his eyes. He spoke a record 173 times at the convention, leading William Pierce to marvel at how he charms, captivates, and leads away the senses of all who hear him. The polyglot Morris was a bon vivant who admitted that he had naturally a taste for pleasure. At King's College, he had composed essays on wit and beauty and on love. Like many flirtatious men who oozed charm, the tall boy was thought superficial, even decadent, by more austere observers. John Adams said he was a man of wit and made pretty verses, but of a character très légère. In a similarly deprecatory vein, John Jay once wrote of the Randy Morris, "Gouverneur's leg has been a tax on my heart. I am almost tempted to wish he had lost something else." Morris's peg leg did not seem to detract from his sexual appeal, and may even have enhanced it. Hamilton and Morris felt a mutual affinity, flavored with some hearty cynicism. Morris admired Hamilton's intellect even as he reproved him for being indiscreet, vain, and opinionated. Repaying the compliment, Hamilton called Morris a man of great genius, liable, however, to be occasionally influenced by his fancy, which sometimes outruns his discretion. On another occasion, Hamilton branded Morris a native of this country, but by genius an exotic. There is a splendid, if unsubstantiated, story about Hamilton and Morris at the convention that rings true and conveys Morris's ironic, self-assured style. Hamilton and Morris were discussing how Washington signaled to people that they should maintain a respectful distance and not behave too familiarly with him. Hamilton wagered Morris that he would not dare to accost Washington with a friendly slap on the back. Taking up the challenge, Morris found Washington standing by the fireplace in the drawing room and genially cuffed him on the shoulder. "My dear General, how happy I am to see you look so well." Washington fixed Morris with such a frigid gaze that Morris was sorry that he had ever taken up Hamilton's dare. As a member of the Style Committee, Hamilton showed that for all his misgivings about the Constitution, he could be cooperative and play a serviceable part. The convention showed good judgment in choosing him, given his literary gifts and rapid pen. It is hard to believe that the Committee of Style and Arrangement took only 4 days to burnish syllables that were to be painstakingly explicated by future generations. The objective was to make the document short and flexible, its language specific enough to constrain abuses, but general enough to allow room for growth. As its chief draftsman, Morris shrank the original 23 articles to 7 and wrote the great preamble with its ringing opening, "We the people of the United States." Paying tribute to Morris's craftsmanship, Madison wrote, "The finish given to the style and arrangement fairly belongs to the pen of Mr. Morris." On September 17, 1787, after almost 4 months of hard-fought battles, the convention ended when 39 delegates from 12 states signed the Constitution. By scrapping the Articles of Confederation and placing the states under a powerful central government, it represented a monumental achievement. Since Lansing and Yates remained stubborn holdouts, Hamilton ended up as the lone New York delegate to sign the charter. The names of the states preceding the signatures appear in his handwriting. It must have been with both relief and joy that Washington entered in his diary that night, "Met in convention, when the Constitution received the unanimous assent of 11 states and Colonel Hamilton's from New York." In the end, the headstrong Hamilton subordinated his ego to the common good. At the signing, he announced categorical support for the Constitution and appealed to the delegates for unanimous approval. Reported Madison, "Mr. Hamilton expressed his anxiety, that is, eagerness, that every member should sign. A few characters of consequence, by opposing or even refusing to sign the Constitution, might do infinite mischief by kindling the latent sparks which lurk under an enthusiasm in favor of the convention, which may soon subside. No man's ideas were more remote from the plan than his were known to be. But is it possible to deliberate between anarchy and convulsion on one side, and the chance of good to be expected from the plan on the other?" After signing, the delegates adjourned to the City Tavern, which John Adams described as the most genteel tavern in America, for a farewell dinner. Behind the conviviality lurked unspoken fears, and Washington, for one, doubted that the new federal government would survive 20 years. The delegates decided that the Constitution would take effect when 9 state conventions approved it. For tactical and philosophical reasons, state legislatures were bypassed in favor of independent ratifying conventions. This would prevent state officials hostile to the new federal government from killing it off. Also, by having autonomous conventions approve the Constitution, the new republic would derive its legitimacy not from the state houses, but directly from the citizenry, enabling federal law to supersede state legislation. With the possible exception of James Madison, nobody had exerted more influence than Hamilton in bringing about the convention, or a greater influence afterward in securing passage of its sterling product. His behavior at the convention itself was another matter. It would long seem contradictory, and to Jeffersonians, downright suspicious, that Hamilton could support a document that he had contested at such length. In fact, the Constitution represented a glorious compromise for every signer. This flexibility has always been honored as a sign of political maturity, whereas Hamilton's concessions have often been given a conspiratorial twist. For the rest of his life, Hamilton remained utterly true to his pledge that he would do everything in his power to see the Constitution successfully implemented. He never wavered either in public or private. And there was a great deal in the document that was compatible with ideas about government that he had expressed since 1780. His reservations had less to do with the powers of the new government than with the tenure of the people exercising them. In the end, nobody would do more than Alexander Hamilton to infuse life into this parchment and make it the working mandate of the American government. Chapter 13. Publius. For all its gore and mayhem, the American Revolution had unified the 13 states, binding them into a hopeful, if still restive, nation. The aftermath of the Constitutional Convention, by contrast, turned ugly and divisive, polarizing the populace. 4 days after Hamilton affixed his signature to the Constitution, the Daily Advertiser gave New Yorkers their first glimpse of it, and many blanched in amazement. This charter went far beyond Congress's instructions to rework the Articles of Confederation. It brought forth a brand new government. The old Confederation had simply gone up in smoke. Marinus Willett, once a stalwart of the Sons of Liberty and now New York's sheriff, echoed the consternation among Governor Clinton's entourage when he lambasted the new Constitution as a monster with open mouth and monstrous teeth ready to devour all before it. Amid great uproar and incessant debate, the country began to divide into two groups. Those in favor of the new dispensation and a dominant central government were called, somewhat illogically, Federalists, a name ordinarily applied to supporters of a loose confederation. Opponents of the Constitution, who feared encroachments on state prerogatives, were now termed Anti-Federalists. The two sides projected competing nightmares of what would happen if the other side prevailed. The Federalists evoked disunion, civil war, and foreign intrigue, along with flagrant repudiation of debt and assaults on property. The Anti-Federalists talked darkly of despotism and a monarchy, the ascendancy of the rich, and the outright abolition of the states. If both sides trafficked in hyperbole, we must remember how much was at stake. The revolution had focused on independence from Britain and sidestepped the question of what sort of society America ought to be, a question that could no longer be postponed. Did the revolution herald a new social order, or would it perpetuate something closer to the status quo ante? And didn't the new constitution, by fostering a dominant central government, imitate the British model against which the colonists had rebelled? The brevity and generality of the constitution made it susceptible to many interpretations. One could imagine almost anything about a government that existed only on paper. Paranoid thinking seems to be a legacy of all revolutions, with purists searching for signs of heresy, and the American experience was no exception. Given the well-organized opposition in large states such as Virginia and New York, it seemed likely that it would be an uphill battle to get the Constitution ratified. As often, incredulous citizens studied the document in taverns and coffee houses. Many rejected it at first blush. The convention's secrecy encouraged suspicions of a wicked cabal at work. Patrick Henry, for one, railed against the tyranny of Philadelphia and compared the new charter to the tyranny of George III. Objections to the Constitution ranged from the noble, insistence upon a Bill of Rights or the mandatory rotation of presidents, to the base, a desire to protect local politicians or preserve slavery from an intrusive federal government. The tariff issue held special force in New York, where state customs revenues made other taxes unnecessary. Under the new constitution, customs collection would become a federal monopoly. By the fall of 1787, the debate over the new dispensation obsessed New Yorkers. In the words of one newspaper, "The rage of the season is Jack. What are you, boy? Federal or anti-federal?" The rancor ushered in a golden age of literary assassination in American politics. No etiquette had yet evolved to define the legitimate boundaries of dissent. Poison pen artists on both sides wrote vitriolic essays that were overtly partisan, often paid scant heed to accuracy, and sought a visceral impact. The inflamed rhetoric once directed against Britain was now turned inward against domestic adversaries. The Clintonians were still smarting over Hamilton's midsummer invective against the governor. Their animosity was further riled in early September when a newspaper scribe called Rough Carver ridiculed Clinton as the thick-skulled and double-hearted chief of those who will coolly oppose everything which does not bear the marks of self. For several weeks, a violent press battle raged between Federalists and Anti-Federalists. The Clintonian response to Rough Carver appeared under a Republican and took deadly aim at Hamilton and the lordly faction that wanted to establish a system more favorable to their aristocratic views. This led to a Federalist rebuttal by Aristides that sketched a heroic portrait of Hamilton as a sublime human being, impelled from pure principles, who had sounded a noble and patriotic alarm against the dangers of the Articles of Confederation. Never one to dodge controversy, Hamilton admitted that he had written the anonymous summer attack on Clinton. But then, far from laying the feud to rest, he renewed the offensive. For Hamilton, Clinton epitomized the flaws of the old Confederation, and he denounced the pernicious intrigues of a man high in office to preserve power and emolument to himself at the expense of the Union, the peace, and the happiness of America. Hamilton presented himself as a paragon of virtue, a tactic that later came back to haunt him. Writing of himself in the third person, he issued this challenge to his opponents. "Mr. Hamilton can, however, defy all their malevolent ingenuity to produce a single instance of his conduct, public or private, inconsistent with the strict rules of integrity and honor." George Clinton responded to Hamilton's declaration of war on two levels. The governor almost certainly authored seven essays signed Cato that set forth reasoned objections to the Constitution. Cato wanted a stronger Congress, more members in the House of Representatives, and a weak president restricted to one term. Then a pair of newspaper articles styled Inspector showed just how vicious the calumny against Hamilton would be. Hamilton was portrayed as the uppity Tom S. **T, Tom Shit, and introduced as a mustee, the offspring of a white person and a quadroon. This was the first time that Hamilton's opponents tried to denigrate him with charges of mixed racial ancestry. Tom Shit is mocked for his Creolian writing. In a soliloquy, Tom, a conceited upstart and British lackey, says, "My dear masters, I am indeed leading a very hard life in your service. Consider the great sacrifices I have made for you. By birth a subject of His Danish Majesty, I quitted my native soil in the torrid zone and called myself a North American for your sakes." Tom is accused of having sent his Phocian essays, defending persecuted Tories, straight from the king's printer in England. After castigating Hamilton as a treacherous foreigner, the author refers to Washington as Hamilton's immaculate daddy, a snide reference to Hamilton's illegitimacy. Thus began the baseless mythology, which persists to this day, that Hamilton was Washington's natural child. Inspector seemed to know all about Hamilton's notorious June 18th speech at the convention, but the secret nature of the deliberations made it impossible to print anything directly. So, in the next installment, he concocted an allegory in which a Mrs. Columbia asks Tom Shit how best to run her plantation. Tom replies that the plantation superintendent should be installed for life instead of for 4-year terms. The author concludes, "Such strides Tom had already made in emerging from obscurity that he conceived nothing was beyond the reach of his good fortune." Evidently, Clintonians thought the time had come to chop Hamilton down to size by jeering at his foreign birth, his supposed racial identity, his illegitimacy, and his putative links to the British crown, attacks that set a pattern for the rest of Hamilton's career. Since critics found it hard to defeat him on intellectual grounds, they stooped to personal attacks. In late September, Hamilton jotted down some unpublished reflections on the Constitution. He was guardedly hopeful that it would be ratified as men of property closed ranks to stop the depredations which the democratic spirit is apt to make on property. He thought it would also be supported by creditors eager to see government debt repaid. On the other hand, it would be resisted by state politicians who feared a decrease in their power and citizens who dreaded new taxes. If the Constitution was not ratified, Hamilton expected a dismemberment of the Union and monarchies in different portions of it, or else several Republican confederacies. If civil war came, he foresaw a possible reversion to colonial status. A reunion with Great Britain, from universal disgust at a state of commotion, is not impossible, though not much to be feared. Presumably, Hamilton meant that it was not likely. The most plausible shape of such a business would be the establishment of a son of the present British monarchy in the supreme government of this country with a family compact. Impelled by such fears, Hamilton flung himself into defending the Constitution. Throughout his career, he operated in the realm of the possible, taking the world as it was, not as he wished it to be, and he often inveighed against a dogmatic insistence upon perfection. Being a lawyer may have eased his transition from arch-skeptic to supreme admirer of the Constitution, for he had the attorney's ability to make the best case for an imperfect client. He was not alone in making this transition. All the delegates at Philadelphia had adopted the final document in a spirit of compromise. They approached it as a collective work and championed it as the best available solution. What Jefferson said of George Washington could easily have applied to Hamilton. "He has often declared to me that he considered our new Constitution as an experiment on the practicability of republic government, and that he was determined the experiment should have a fair trial and would lose the last drop of his blood in support of it. I do believe that General Washington had not a firm confidence in the durability of our government." Hamilton was no less hopeful, no less committed, and certainly no less skeptical. By early October 1787, Hamilton conceived an ambitious writing project to help elect Federalist delegates to the New York Ratifying Convention. A comprehensive explication of the entire document written by New Yorkers for a New York audience. In early October 1787, James Kent encountered Hamilton at a dinner party at the Schuyler Mansion in Albany, where Hamilton was attending the fall session of the state Supreme Court. Philip Schuyler expatiated on the need for a national revenue system while Hamilton listened quietly. Mr. Hamilton appeared to be careless and desultory in his remarks, Kent recalled, and it occurred to me afterwards that he was deeply meditating the plan of the immortal work of the Federalist. Tradition claims that Hamilton wrote the first installment of the masterpiece known as the Federalist Papers in the cabin of a Hudson River sloop as he and Eliza returned to New York from Albany. Eliza recalled going upriver, not down, and said Hamilton laid out the contours of the project as they sailed. My beloved husband wrote the outline of his papers in the Federalist on board of one of the North River sloops while on his way to Albany, a journey which in those days usually occupied a week. Public business so filled up his time that he was compelled to do much of his studying and writing while traveling. Whether he was sailing downriver or upriver, it is pleasant to picture Hamilton scratching out his plan as the tall, single-masted schooner slipped past the Hudson Highlands and the Palisades. This first essay appeared in the Independent Journal on October 27, 1787. Hamilton supervised the entire Federalist project. He dreamed up the idea, enlisted the participants, wrote the overwhelming bulk of the essays, and oversaw the publication. For his first collaborator, he recruited John Jay, a tall, thin, balding man with a pale, melancholy face and a wary look in his deep-set gray eyes. Jay always looked austere, almost gaunt in paintings, though he could show delightful flashes of wit. Descended from Huguenots, the son of a wealthy merchant, Jay had been the major draftsman of the New York State Constitution. Along with Franklin and Adams, he had negotiated the treaty that ended the Revolution and was a longtime Secretary of Foreign Affairs under the Articles of Confederation. With his first-rate mind and unquestioned integrity, he was a superb choice to collaborate on the project. Hamilton and Jay invited in three other authors. Madison wrote, "The undertaking was proposed by Alexander Hamilton to James Madison with a request to join him and Mr. Jay in carrying it into effect. William Dewar was also included in the original plan and wrote two or more papers, which, though intelligent and sprightly, were not continued, nor did they make a part of the printed collection." Hamilton courted Governor Morris, who said he was warmly pressed by Hamilton to assist in writing the Federalist, but was too harried by business to consent. That Hamilton approached Morris and Madison shows that he wanted the anonymous essays to profit from detailed knowledge of the convention's inner workings. He always believed that the framers' intentions were important, though not decisive. He said the Constitution must speak for itself. Yet, to candid minds, the contemporary explanations of it by men who had had a perfect opportunity of knowing the views of its framers must operate as a weighty collateral reason for believing the construction agreeing with this explanation to be right, rather than the opposite one. Each author was assigned an area corresponding to his expertise. Jay naturally handled foreign relations. Madison, versed in the history of republics and confederacies, covered much of that ground. As author of the Virginia Plan, he also undertook to explain the general anatomy of the new government. Hamilton took those branches of government most congenial to him, the executive, the judiciary, and some sections on the Senate. Previewing things to come, he also covered military matters and taxation. The Federalist essays first appeared in newspapers. The authors had to camouflage their identities behind a pseudonym, lest they be accused of betraying the confidentiality of the convention. At first, Hamilton planned to publish the pieces under the rubric of a citizen of New York, but changed it when James Madison of Virginia was recruited to the project. He then selected the pen name Publius, which he had first used in 1778 when he berated Samuel Chase for wartime profiteering. It was an apposite choice. Publius Valerius had toppled the last Roman king and set up the republican foundations of government. Hamilton rushed a copy to Mount Vernon without identifying himself as its author. "For the remaining numbers of Publius," Washington responded, "I shall acknowledge yourself obliged, as I am persuaded the subject will be well handled by the author." Jay wrote the next four numbers, then had to drop out because of a severe bout of rheumatism. In the final tally, the Federalist Papers ran to 85 essays, with 51 attributed to Hamilton, 29 to Madison, and only 5 to Jay. Since Hamilton had not reckoned on Jay's illness and had expected to include Morris and Dewar, he could never have anticipated that he and Madison would write so much in 7 months, some 175,000 words in all, or that the Federalist would essentially settle down to a two-man enterprise. Thanks to the cooperation of Hamilton and Madison, New York emerged as the main arena of intellectual combat over the new plan of government. The project's magnitude mushroomed tremendously from its origins, as indicated by Archibald MacLean, the Hanover Square printer who published the bound version and felt beleaguered by the project. "When I engaged to do the work," he groused to Robert Troup, "it was to consist of 20 numbers, or at the most 25. Instead of one projected volume of 200 pages, MacLean complained, the Federalist ended up running to two volumes of about 600 pages. To worsen matters, the luckless printer was stuck with several hundred unsold copies and grumbled that he didn't clear £5 on the whole deal. For Archibald MacLean, the Federalist Papers were a dreadful flop, an unfortunate publishing venture best forgotten. To safeguard his anonymity, Hamilton sent the early essays to the newspapers via Robert Troup. If Hamilton was out of town, he sometimes sent them to Eliza, who may have then relayed them along to Troup. Later, as it became an open secret in New York political circles that Hamilton was the chief author, newspaper publisher Samuel Loudon went straight to Hamilton's office for fresh copy. Many people knew that Hamilton, Madison, and Jay were the authors, but the trio proclaimed their authorship to only a chosen few, and then mostly after the first bound volume was published in March 1788. Madison furnished Jefferson with the relevant names in code, while Hamilton sent Washington the book version and observed, "I presume you have understood that the writers are chiefly Mr. Madison and myself, with some aid from Mr. Jay." More sensitive was the question of who wrote what. Hamilton and Madison forged a pact that they would reveal this only by mutual agreement, initiating 2 centuries of scholarly disputation over the authorship of approximately 15 of the essays. True to their pledge, Hamilton and Madison remained coy on the subject. The Federalist has been extolled as both a literary and political masterpiece. Theodore Roosevelt commented that it is, on the whole, the greatest book dealing with practical politics. Its achievement is the more astonishing for having been written under such fierce deadline pressure. The first of the staggered series of ratifying conventions was scheduled to start in late November, and this allowed Hamilton and Madison little opportunity for fresh research or reflection. They agreed to deliver 4 essays per week, that is, 2 apiece, at roughly 3-day intervals, leaving little time for revision. The essays then appeared in 4 of the 5 New York newspapers. The constantly looming deadlines meant that the authors had to draw on information, ideas, and citations already stored in their minds or notes. Luckily, they had both been in training for several years. Madison explained to Jefferson, "Though the publication is carried on in concert, the writers are not mutually answerable for all the ideas of each other, there being seldom time for even a perusal of the pieces by any but the writer before they are wanted at the press, and sometimes, hardly, by the writer himself." So excruciating was the schedule, Madison said, that often, whilst the printer was putting into type parts of a number, the following parts were under the pen and to be furnished in time for the press. Very often, Hamilton and Madison first read each other's contributions in print. Madison was aided by his convention notes and crib sheets from his preparatory reading. Without these scholarly crutches, he confessed, the performance must have borne a very different aspect. For Hamilton, it was a period of madcap activity. He was stuck with his law practice and had to squeeze the essays into breaks in his schedule as if they were a minor sideline. Robert Troup noted of Hamilton's haste in writing The Federalist, "All the numbers written by Hamilton were composed under the greatest possible pressure of business, for he always had a vast deal of law business to engage his attention." Troup remembered seeing Samuel Loudon in Hamilton's study, waiting to take numbers of The Federalist as they came fresh from his pen, in order to publish them in the next paper. During one prodigious burst after Madison returned to Virginia, Hamilton churned out 21 straight essays in a 2-month period. On 2 occasions, he published 5 essays in a single week and published 6 in one spectacular week when writing on taxation. Hamilton's mind always worked with preternatural speed. His collected papers are so stupefying in length that it is hard to believe that one man created them in fewer than 5 decades. Words were his chief weapons, and his account books are crammed with purchases for thousands of quills, parchments, penknives, slate pencils, reams of foolscap, and wax. His papers show that, Mozart-like, he could transpose complex thoughts onto paper with few revisions. At other times, he tinkered with the prose, but generally did not alter the logical progression of his thought. He wrote with the speed of a beautifully organized mind that digested ideas thoroughly, slotted them into appropriate pigeonholes, then regurgitated them at will. To understand Hamilton's productivity, it is important to note that virtually all of his important work was journalism, prompted by topical issues and written in the midst of controversy. He never wrote as a solitary philosopher for the ages. His friend Nathaniel Pendleton remarked, "His eloquence seemed to require opposition to give it its full force." But his topical writing has endured because he plumbed the timeless principles behind contemporary events. Whether in legal briefs or sustained polemics, he wanted to convince people through appeals to their reason. He had an incomparable capacity for work and a metabolism that thrived on conflict. His stupendous output came from the interplay of superhuman stamina and intellect and a fair degree of repetition. Hamilton developed ingenious ways to wring words from himself. One method was to walk the floor as he formed sentences in his head. William Sullivan left an excellent vignette of Hamilton's intense method of composition. One who knew his habits of study said of him that when he had a serious object to accomplish, his practice was to reflect on it previously. And when he had gone through this labor, he retired to sleep, without regard to the hour of the night, and having slept 6 or 7 hours, he rose and, having taken strong coffee, seated himself at his table, where he would remain 6, 7, or 8 hours, and the product of his rapid pen required little correction for the press. Since Hamilton's abiding literary sin was prolixity, the time and length constraints imposed by the Federalist may have given a salutary concision to his writing. For all his charisma, Alexander Hamilton was essentially an intellectual loner who took perverse pride in standing against the crowd. All the more remarkable that his greatest literary triumph came in close collaboration with Madison and Jay. After leaving the convention in Philadelphia, Madison had returned to his lodgings at 19 Maiden Lane in Manhattan, where he resided with other Virginia delegates to the now almost moribund Confederation Congress. Later anointed the father of the Constitution, Madison had many reservations about the document, especially the equal representation of states in the Senate, and was content at first to let others take up the cudgels in its defense. He also thought it proper that others should assess the convention's work. But by late October, he was so upset by the grotesque distortions of the Constitution and the furor whipped up by the New York press that he agreed to work with Hamilton on the Federalist. Americans often wonder how this moment could have spawned such extraordinary men as Hamilton and Madison. Part of the answer is that the Revolution produced an insatiable need for thinkers who could generate ideas and wordsmiths who could lucidly expound them. The immediate utility of ideas was an incalculable tonic for the founding generation. The fate of the democratic experiment depended upon political intellectuals who might have been marginalized at other periods. At this crossroads, Hamilton and Madison must have seemed an odd pair in the New York streets. Hamilton, 32, the peacock, wearing bright colors and chattering gaily, and Madison, 36, the crow in habitual black with a quiet, more reflective manner. When French journalist J.P. Brissot de Warville met them that year, it was the older Madison who resembled a pallid young scholar, while Hamilton seemed older and more worldly. "This Republican seems to be no more than 33 years old," the Frenchman wrote of Madison. When I saw him, he looked tired, perhaps as a result of the immense labor to which he had devoted himself recently. His expression was that of a stern censor, his conversation disclosed a man of learning, and his countenance was that of a person conscious of his talents and of his duties. Of Hamilton. Mr. Hamilton is Mr. Madison's worthy rival as well as his collaborator. He looks 38 or 40 years old, is not tall, and has a resolute, frank, soldierly appearance. He has distinguished himself by his eloquence and by the soundness of his reasoning. Hamilton and Madison came to symbolize opposite ends of the political spectrum. At the time of the Federalist Essays, however, they were so close in style and outlook that scholars find it hard to sort out their separate contributions. In general, Madison's style was dense and professorial, Hamilton's more graceful and flowing, yet they had a similar flair for startling epigrams and piercing insights. At this stage, Madison often sounded Hamiltonian and vice versa. Later identified as a strict constructionist of the Constitution, Madison set forth the doctrine of implied powers that Hamilton later used to expand the powers of the federal government. It was Madison who wrote in Federalist No. 44, "No axiom is more clearly established in law or in reason than that wherever the end is required, the means are authorized." At this juncture, they could make common cause on the need to fortify the federal government and curb rampant state abuses. Both Hamilton and Madison were rational men who assumed that people often acted irrationally because of ambition and avarice. Madison wrote, "If men were angels, no government would be necessary." The two shared a grim vision of the human condition, even if Hamilton's had the blacker tinge. They both wanted to erect barriers against irrational popular impulses and tyrannical minorities and majorities. To this end, they thought that public opinion should be distilled by skeptical, sober-minded representatives. Despite Hamilton's reputation as the elitist, the starting point of Madison's most famous essay, Federalist No. 10, is that people possess different natural endowments, leading to an unequal distribution of property and conflicts of classes and interests. In a big, heterogeneous country, Madison argued, these conflicting interests would neutralize one another, checking abuses of power. "Let ambition counteract ambition," he wrote in Federalist No. 51. If Madison displays a broader knowledge of theory and history in The Federalist, Hamilton betrays wider knowledge of the world. With his itinerant background, he brought commercial, military, and political expertise to bear. This was especially true in discussions of political economy, in which he outshone Madison. Madison showed more interest in constitutional curbs against tyrannical encroachments, whereas Hamilton lauded spurs to action. In sections of the Federalist dealing with the executive and judicial branches, Hamilton pressed his case for vigor and energy in government, a hobby horse he was to ride for the rest of his career. At the same time, he was always careful to reconcile the need for order with the thirst for liberty. Bernard Bailyn has written that the Constitution, in creating a strong central government, the Federalist argued, did not betray the Revolution, with its radical hopes for greater political freedom than had been known before. Quite the contrary, it fulfilled those radical aspirations by creating the power necessary to guarantee both the nation's survival and the preservation of the people and the state's rights. Let us pause to survey the Federalist with special attention to Hamilton's contributions, for these essays testify to the extraordinary breadth of his thinking. As author of the opening salvo, Hamilton began with a flourish, addressing the series to the people of the state of New York. After an unequivocal experience of the inefficacy of the subsisting federal government, you are called upon to deliberate on a new constitution for the United States of America. The main question was whether good governments could be created from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident and force. One can almost see Hamilton declaiming as he announced that the outcome of the ratifying conventions would determine the fate of an empire, and that rejection would be a general misfortune of mankind. Hamilton questioned the motives of the Constitution's opponents and censured the two types who had populated his political nightmares: state politicians, read George Clinton, who feared an erosion of their power, and demagogues who fed off popular confusion while proclaiming popular rights. Jefferson later took this starring role. Hamilton warned that a dangerous ambition more often lurks behind the specious mask of zeal for the rights of the people than under the forbidding appearance of zeal for the firmness and efficiency of government. Having set the stage, Hamilton outlined the general plan of the future essays, but did not specify their number. In the next four essays, John Jay showed how weak and vulnerable the Confederation had been in foreign affairs. Then Hamilton devoted four essays to the pernicious domestic consequences that would ensue if the Articles of Confederation endured and states continued to bicker with one another. With his penchant for disaster scenarios, Hamilton cited dire precedents from ancient Greece to Shay's Rebellion. In Federalist No. 6, he mocked as wishful thinking the notion that democratic republics would necessarily be peaceful. Are not popular assemblies frequently subject to the impulses of rage, resentment, jealousy, avarice, and of other irregular and violent propensities? This prophet of global trade also dismissed the pipe dream that commerce invariably unites nations. Has commerce hitherto done anything more than change the objects of war? Is not the love of wealth as domineering and enterprising a passion as that of power or glory? Hamilton disputed that America would be an Eden governed by a special providence. Is it not time to awake from the deceitful dream of a golden age and to adopt as a practical maxim for the direction of our political conduct that we, as well as the other inhabitants of the globe, are yet remote from the happy empire of perfect wisdom and perfect virtue? Starting with Federalist No. 7, Hamilton reviewed the numberless things that states could squabble about without a strong union. The lack of fortifications and standing armies would only exacerbate wars among the states, tempting bigger states to behave in predatory fashion toward smaller ones. The resulting chaos would lead to the very despotic militarism that anti-federalists feared, for in such a situation, the people are brought to consider the soldiery not only as their protectors, but as their superiors. While conceding that republics had produced disorders in the past, Hamilton noted that progress in the science of politics had fostered principles that would prevent most abuses. The division of powers among departments, legislative checks and balances, an independent judiciary, and representation by elected legislators. When Jay fell ill, Madison brilliantly leaped into the void with his celebrated Federalist No. 10, the most influential of all the essays, in which he took issue with Montesquieu's theory that democracy could survive only in small states. Standing this argument on its head, Madison showed that in a more extensive republic, interest groups would counterbalance one another and avert tyrannical majorities. In Federalist Numbers 11 through 13, Hamilton displayed his practical, administrative bent as he explained the advantages of the new union for commerce, as well as government revenues and expenses. He revealed America's commercial destiny as he prophesied that envious European states would try to clip the wings by which we might soar to a dangerous greatness. With a powerful union, America would strike better commercial bargains and create a respectable navy. He offered an expansive view of prosperous American merchants, farmers, artisans, and manufacturers, all working together. In a sudden flash of economic foresight, he anticipated 20th century monetary theory. The ability of a country to pay taxes must always be proportioned, in a great degree, to the quantity of money in circulation and to the celerity, what economists now call velocity, with which it circulates. Blessed with a potent union, the government would collect customs duties with greater efficiency, since it would not have to stop contraband among the states and need only patrol the Atlantic seaboard. Americans would likewise save money by having a single country rather than the separate confederacies that might stem from disunion. All this was a further rebuttal to Montesquieu's view that large republics could never survive. In Federalist Numbers 15 through 22, Hamilton and then Madison skewered the anarchic state of the Confederation. Pride and honor always loomed large in Hamilton's value system, both personal and political, and he mourned the national degradation and loss of dignity after the Revolution. The United States had become a pariah country, sneered at by foreign states. We have neither troops, nor treasury, nor government. Land and property values had plummeted, money had grown scarce, public credit had been destroyed, all because the central government lacked power. And it lacked that power because it had to rely for revenue upon the states, who competed to provide the least money to it. Only if the federal government could deal directly with its citizens and not fear obstruction from the states could it be a true government. End of Disc 10.